Hi, I'm John Popola, and you're listening to the Emergent Order Podcast. On this episode of the Emergent Order Podcast, I have a conversation with Johan Norberg. Johan is an accomplished author and student of globalization and global economics, and he's really been an advocate for classical liberal thinking from a uniquely Scandinavian perspective. While I was producing my film, The Pursuit, with Arthur Brooks, we traveled to Denmark to explore the Danish model, the Danish system of economics, because there are many Americans who believe that we should become more like what they believe the Scandinavian countries to be. And one of the interesting things is that what we hear the Scandinavian countries are here in the States isn't much like what the Scandinavian countries actually are in reality. And so I couldn't think of a better person to talk through this than Johan Norberg. Johan and I also discussed the Swedish response to the coronavirus pandemic. Sweden took a very different approach to how they restricted their citizens and made recommendations compared with the United States and many other countries around the world. It was an approach that I personally thought made a lot more sense and treated people like adults. But it's one that came under scathing criticism and seems to have outperformed everyone's expectations. So we talk about that and many other things. And so I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with Johan Norberg. Johan Norberg, I'm very excited to have you on because in a lot of ways, I feel like America is in the midst of a false debate over whether or not it wants to be Sweden, but really whether or not it wants to be a Sweden that's been made up in the minds of some Americans. And you hosted a film about your homeland and its economic system, and you've been an incredible voice for economics. And being from Sweden and being a sort of neoliberal laissez-faire economist has, I think, always made you such a distinct voice. And so I'm excited to just talk to you about where, you know, how you came to think the way you think and what lessons I want to learn from you about, you know, what works and doesn't work in the Scandinavian model and where we might be heading and all these things. So, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, John. A pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So I guess I want to start, as I was saying, or, you know, before we started recording, kind of at the beginning. How did you get interested in this world of ideas and economics and philosophy? Where does that begin for you? Were you a rambunctious philosophical high schooler? Like, where did it start?
Well, yeah, actually, it started in high school when I started my the one and only political party that I started, which was an anarchist party back in the day. Not right, not left, more confused and combining sort of, you know, dismantle industrial civilization and abolishing the government, but most specifically abolishing the ban on bicycles in the schoolyard. So that's where I started. I got interested in ideas early on, often skeptical against any kind of oppression and someone thinking they're smarter than we are, than people in general. That seems like more common sense is with the people or the pupils rather than the headmaster, the teacher, the government, the bureaucrats, the politicians, but never really understanding where to go with it. So that's where I started. Lots of toss and turn and understanding that this is not quite the way forward, and I had to change my mind a little bit here and there.
So you tweaked the dismantling of industrial civilization
a slight nudge.
Yeah, that's right. I'm still hostile to many aspects of our big government, but that thing with the industrial civilization, I realized that there was something to it. And that's really something that I got from history, I think. I had this idea that there had to be some sort of better past, some good old days where we lived more in harmony with one another and with nature. And then when I studied history, and specifically my ancestors' history in northern Sweden, I realized that they didn't live ecologically, they died ecologically, because when they had bad weather, there was a crop failure and people starved to death. Without railways, without international trade, without industrial civilization, basically, high-yielding crops, artificial fertilizer, life was misery, and life expectancy was 30, 40 years. And that made me obsessed with thinking about progress. What makes it possible? Why is it that we can live with the kind of opportunities and the life expectancy, the health, the wealth that we have today, because we cannot take it for granted?
You know, you're one of a group of economists and thinkers that, you know, you could call them a couple different things, like rational optimists, boomers, as in boom instead of doom or gloom. And I'm deeply moved by that sort of positive, optimistic view of human progress. And yet, whenever you go into a fairly large group of people and ask them, is the world getting better or worse? Somewhere between 75 and 85% will think it's getting worse. Has that been your experience? Because it seems to play out in a lot of different domains. Is poverty going... What direction is poverty going in? What direction is, human rights going in? People across the board will think it's getting worse, but by a large majority. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The one poll that made an impression on me was the asking the British, so do you think the world on a whole is getting better or worse? 5% thought that the world on a whole was getting better in an era when we just halved extreme poverty in some 15 years. The Americans are a little bit more optimistic, obviously. So 6% on the whole thought that the world was getting better rather than worse. So more people believe in ghosts and astrology and UFOs than believe in human progress. And that's obviously quite bizarre when you look at the facts, when you look at the data, all the indicators on human well-being, health, wealth, and opportunities. I mean, it's not as good as we'd like it to be, but it has been getting better than ever before in human history. So if you can't appreciate that, you've kind of lost it. So why is that? Well, I think there are many aspects to it. I think one of them is that we are, let's face it, we're a bit of a boring species. We are a problem-solving species, Homo sapiens, but that also means that we're completely focused on problems. We've got to be. Our ancestors had to be, because if they were happy by the campfire and thinking, look, we've hunted and gathered lots more in the past week than ever before, let's be happy, they were probably killed by a storm or a predator or something. Whereas those who were anxiously looking to the horizon, where's the next problem going to come from? They survived, and they passed on their genes and their stress hormones to us. So we should be grateful to them for that, but it's kind of a mixed blessing, because it means that we're always completely focused on what's the next thing that could go wrong. And we have to be focused on that, we think, because it's a matter of survival. And that's true historically, but now with, 24 our cable news and social media constantly going on. Something is going wrong somewhere on the planet, and then that's broadcasted to us, and we think that we have to focus on that problem because it might kill us. Well, yeah, it might, but there are other things happening as well.
I mean, I think this has been, I had a conversation with Matt Ridley back in March or April. It was soon after he wrote a piece that was very not Matt Ridley of him, which was about the pandemic and that this might be the wolf, you know, in the old story of the boy who cried wolf, that the wolf eventually comes. And it's a very difficult time in right now in particular to hold on to optimism. What are you finding? Have you found anything that's changed in your own mindset as we've, you know, in 2020 as an optimist, as someone that writes about and celebrates human progress and pushes back against this sort of evolved proclivity to catastrophize and look at the worst?
Yeah, I think two things have happened. First of all, I've become more of a radical, almost dogmatic optimist because of the pandemic, because I have to ask myself, so if a pandemic has to happen at some point, and it's bound to, because it happens eventually, constantly throughout history, it's going to happen in the future as well. So when's the best year to suffer from a pandemic? Well, I would have to say so far it's 2020, because we've got not just sort of this kind of ability to communicate so that we can do these things and we can meet our colleagues and family and friends, even though we should be socially distancing, but also the ability to deal with it, the kind of medical drugs, the ability to read the genome of the virus and to create a vaccine in a shorter time than has ever been done before. This is the time to experience a virus like that. So that makes me an optimist. At the same time, obviously, we know that bad things happen when people become afraid of the world. And, you know, my latest book, Open the Story of Human Progress, which is just being published now, is, and I finished the first draft before the pandemic, it said that the history of human civilization is that openness, open societies, open exchange and so on, creates progress. But in times of trouble, in times of crisis, we mess up. We create this kind of the fear of the world, and then we shut things down. We look to big governments and strong men to protect us, and that ruins openness and progress. And my conclusion was that great depressions, threat of invasions, natural disasters, and pandemics, they have this tendency of shutting our minds and us, making us afraid of freedom, basically. So it's not a surprise to me that it happens now, but I get a bit concerned when it happens this quickly, the kind of shutdowns that we've had, the kind of deglobalization that we've seen. And in just a few months, it has probably meant that somewhere around 100 million people have been thrown into extreme poverty because of this deglobalization that we're living with right now. And that's gotta make anyone depressed about what we're doing.
So I want to get to the ten reasons to look forward to the future, because man, do we need that. But I want to let's go back again to your economic sort of history, sort of how you're the evolution of your thinking, because when you went to college, right? So what did you study? What drove your early interests in university?
Well, actually, lots of stuff. And I think I started out with philosophy, and then lots of things happened political science and economics and learning stuff here and there. But the subject that really got me interested in and taught me to, I think, understand what's going on in the world was history, and specifically the history of ideas, because that's a combination of everything that has ever happened to us. It's economic history, it's science, it's philosophy, it's what we've done and how that has affected how we think about the world. And then studying history, it teaches you two things, I think. First of all, it teaches you you cannot be a historian in any way without being an optimist about the world, because you realize how miserable all our ancestors had it. And it's only us, a few generations who've lived like this. But it also makes you a little bit of a cynic, because you realize that once in a while we ruin it all and we destroy it, and we start trade wars and real wars, and we ruin this openness and this freedom. And that taught me as well that we can't take progress for granted. It doesn't happen automatically. It's dependent on exploration, experiments, innovation, and that takes freedom. And that's not something that we get automatically.
It's was there a thinker that had a huge impact on you? Milton Friedman or someone else that sort of was a, did you have a light bulb moment? Because the ideas you're talking about, it doesn't seem like they're ever broadly in the ether. They're always like classical liberalism or neoliberalism, whatever you want to call sort of our tribe of thinkers. We're always sort of this nutty minority. Were you always sort of inclined towards this sort of free market, sort of optimistic way of thinking, or was there somebody that was like a really important person for you?
You know, it's being brought up before the internet, it was quite difficult to find anyone who thought like first. And I had to go into the libraries looking for the books. And at first I found people who attacked ideas that were a little bit similar to what I thought. So, but that was more like the classical liberals, Cobden and Bright, the Manchester School, Adam Smith, things like that, and realizing that there were ideas about how, even back then in the 1700s and the 1800s, about how progress is possible. We can do this if people are allowed to create and exchange the results. So that got me interested in modern versions of that. And reading Hayek and Friedman and Ayn Rand really influenced me, realizing that there are others out there who've been thinking about this. I would say, when it comes to my thoughts on progress and that optimism is possible, Julian Simon, the grand old man of development optimism, was really influential, because he showed in both sort of spirit and empirical data on everything that, look, as long as people are allowed, given the freedom to just experiment, they're going to surprise you and they're going to do great things.
Yeah, I've been thinking about doing another rap video about focusing this time on Simon versus Ehrlich as the avatars in the battle over the doomers versus the boomers.
That's a brilliant idea.
I mean, lay out for people who aren't familiar with Julian Simon, what was his fundamental argument? You know, what are his ideas that you pick up, and that you obviously are sort of a Simonite, if you will. So yeah, help for somebody coming in cold and doesn't know who Julian Simon is. Like, what was he all about? Yeah. What was his contribution?
Yeah. He was a, for lack of a better word, the great humanist who really saw the value of human beings and realizing that the ultimate resource in an era when people thought that we're running out of resources because, you see, we use them up. So we're going to run out of everything that we need. He pointed out that, look, the ultimate resource is the human brain. It's human ability and imagination, and the fact that we always come up with new things if we are given the chance to do it, to acquire education, accumulate knowledge, and the freedom to innovate and create new things. So let's look at, for example, take aluminium. So if we're going to use it like we're doing right now, a simple projection would say that, look, in 30 years, we won't have any aluminium left on the planet, because more of us use more of it all the time. So we're going to run out of it. That's what Ehrlich and all the pessimists said. Whereas Julian Simon pointed out, that's not how it works, because you missed one thing in the equation, and that's human beings and the fact that they can look at the problem out there and do something about it. So if we use too much of it and there's too much demand, the price will increase. And in that case, that's an incentive to all of us to find substitutes, to conserve these resources, to, for example, reduce the weight of a can made of aluminium from 85 grams to 12 grams today, something like that, because every innovator, entrepreneur who came up with an idea to reduce the wall of it just by with an ingenious fold somehow, just by a thousandth of a, then they would make millions, and they will continue to do it, and obviously start to invent ways of recycling it. Most of the aluminium that we've ever used is still in use today because we've come up with better ways of recycling it. So all those who use computer models to try to explain that we will run out of X, Y, Z, they have great models and they've got great input. It's just that they lose out human beings. They miss the human brain. And as Julian Simon puts it, it's the one resource. It's not just the ultimate resource. It's the one that's sort of infinitely renewable in a pleasurable way.
You know, one of the things that has come out of that pessimist worldview that is the most upsetting is the mirror opposite view, right? That humans are a kind of plague, or in the Matrix, the agent says, you know, humanity is a virus and we are the cure. And that sort of was capturing, I think, a lot of ways, the Ehrlich population bomb mindset that we still see it today. We hear all these admonitions to have fewer children in order to save the planet or save Earth. And I know I'm being a little dismissive, which is maybe not fair, but it's hard for me not to be, because it's such a deeply anti-human worldview. But trace that back. Where does that come from? You know, what's been your observation of the impact of that, this sort of humanity as a consumer, as a virus, as a plague? You know, where did that start? You know, has that always been with us? I mean, is it Malthus? Is it before him?
Yeah, it's easy to trace it back to Malthus, because he was the one who really popularized the idea that we'll just consume the way we used to consume, and the more of us we become, then the more we'll use, and we'll run out of it, and we'll all die. But the thing is that, and there were many predecessors. But the thing was that he was quite right by then, because historically that's what happened on the planet. The moment people often got lucky because of a better climate, or they stumbled onto some innovation or better soil so they could produce more kids, and then they'll run into that wall of scarcity and people started dying. So it's not that strange that people thought that way, thinking of human beings just like any kind of animal who just consumes until they run into that wall or fall off that cliff. And Paul Ehrlich, I mean, he studied insects and ants, and so that's where he got it from. And yeah, obviously, if they have something to consume, they'll consume and reproduce until they run out of resources generally. The new thing on the planet is that in the last 200 years, we've created systems where we've made the world safe for progress, for innovation, so that you could go move on to worse land, the periphery, but you could add higher yielding crops, you could add irrigation systems, artificial fertilizer, today genetically modified organisms. And our models and our brains are not really, haven't really evolved to deal with that kind of change, that imagination, that innovation, because it is fairly new. So it's not that surprising, but it's scary that people can't embrace that progress when they see it. Today, we're more people on the planet than ever before, and we're actually better fed than ever before. More than 7 billion people on the planet, and yet we've reduced chronic undernourishment from around 50% 70 years ago to around 10% today. It's the most remarkable achievement ever. And that comes from people. And that's the thing. When people say that there are too many people on the planet, well, where does it come from? New ideas about how to produce in better ways, new technologies, gene editing, for example. Well, it comes from people. More people get better education than ever before, have more freedom than ever before to communicate with others who've delved into the same kind of things. Then one of them will stumble onto the next big thing. So we need more people rather than fewer.
So if I'm coming to this conversation, and I've seen, there was a video that came out a while back called The Story of Stuff. I don't know if you ever came across this. It was a woman who was an activist. It sort of took off. It was like an early viral video. And it made this argument that, well, we have a finite planet and we have infinite growth and you can't run that system. And it's just, we're going to run out of everything. There, you know, as you said, it's so intuitive, and our brains are so accustomed to that kind of fixed pie world where, you know, if we have too many people, we'll run out of food. Or, you know, I think also if I see somebody with a lot more berries than me, they took more berries from the only tree we have. So that's theft from the group because they have more berries than the rest of us. That's a separate thing we should talk about, but because I think it's very related philosophically and like, but what have you found breaks through to people? How do you explain this in the simplest terms to someone who's coming in and they just, it's so intuitive, it's so hard to overcome that intuition. Like, what have you found is a great way to explain that to somebody like that?
Well, it is difficult. So let's start there. You know, if the whole of human history is condensed into 24 hours, then almost everything that has improved our life, our lifespans, our health, our wealth, reduction of poverty, and so on, has come in the last 200 years. Now condense those 200 years into those 24 hours, then that's actually the last minute, of those 24 hours. Everything that we all treasure and cherish comes from that 1 minute. Unfortunately, our instincts and our ways of thinking about the world and other people doesn't come from that 1 minute. It comes from the preceding 86,000 seconds or something like that. So it's not strange, as you say, it's not strange that if we see something who is successful and wealthy, we think that that's bad. What a robber baron. Because historically, if someone got very rich, they probably stole it from us. They took our land, they took our treasure. And because very few people lived in a situation where they really saw economic growth and innovation that made a large-scale difference in their own lives, and not over a longer period of time, so that it really affected how people thought about these things. So it's not strange that we're getting innovation wrong, we're getting wealth wrong. We constantly think, and I think this is the major problem in our ways of thinking about the world, we think it's a zero-sum game, because historically most of us lived in a zero-sum game. If the other tribe was successful, it was because they took it from our tribe. Now, the last minute of those 24 hours has been amazing. We've managed to create institutions so that for most people, in at least in the Western world, we've created a system where you can only become successful by giving others knowledge, technology, goods and services that make their lives better. That's the one way to become successful. And it's amazing. It's wonderful. But our brains have not kept up with that change. So how do we deal with that? Well, the problem is that those instincts, they're there. They are pretty hardwired, I would say. We'll always have them there. So what we need is to deal with our default setting by rerouting it and explain economics, explain how things work by, I think, a combination of theory as accessible as possible with empirical data, statistics, and examples, stories that tell you something that you realize on a one-to-one basis, that no deal ever happens without both sides agreeing to it and thinking that they will be better off when they've done it. That's why we have this awkward double thanks when you meet someone when you're in their shop and you're buying something, you thank them, they thank you, because you both benefit from that. You realize that, you understand that intuitively on a one-to-one basis. It gets more complicated in a more complex world where millions of people have produced your computer or made sure that you have your cup of coffee. But it's the same principle, and you have to explain it again and again.
Let's talk about the future and the 10 reasons why we should be optimistic. What's your first in the list for why we should be optimistic? And is it that America is going to become more like Sweden?
I think Sweden has to be a separate discussion.
Yeah, I'm joking.
10
I'm joking.
Reasons. That's got to be the 11th.
Yeah. We'll get to our Swedish futures later in our conversation. But go ahead. Number one.
I think the most important one is that, look, some researchers claimed recently that our natural life expectancy is somewhere below 40 years. And I mean, throughout history, it was around 30 years in most civilizations, in most cultures. Some got lucky, but that's the average. And only some five, six generations have experienced something different. And now we're above 70, we're around 80 in developed countries. That, I think, should make anyone hopeful about the world, realizing that something interesting has happened here. And my favorite example there is, because it's complicated. It's about agricultural productivity. It's about better wealth and knowledge generally. It's about medical knowledge and drugs. But my favorite example is the two different health stories that I read once in the same magazine. One about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, the great composer, and one about George, 10-year-old. And the one about Mozart said that researchers have now realized that it was probably not an exciting conspiracy or poisoning or anything like that. That's not why he died young. He died from a sore throat. So he had something in his throat. It was difficult to talk one day, and his doctor probably said, yeah, you've got a sore throat, so you'll probably die. Because that's how you died 200 years ago, even if you were the greatest composer of all time, with the possible exception of Beethoven, or if you were an emperor or a king. Because we didn't have the knowledge, the science, the technology, antibiotics, and so on. The other story about George, 10-year-old, was about a brain tumor. So he had a brain tumor. The doctors managed to get it out. It was a difficult surgery, and even his heart stopped beating during surgery. But he survived, and he got back to his old happy self. And that's amazing in itself. But it gets even better when you realize that George is not a human being. He's a goldfish. So a goldfish today, or my cat, has access to better medical treatment than the greatest composers and kings and queens had 200 years ago.
A goldfish.
So if you ever are,
goldfish.
A goldfish.
What was the, how did you come across this story, and why would anyone do surgery on a goldfish? How did this happen?
Someone who really loved his goldfish, right? So, but the great thing was, this was a magazine about sort of current events, what's happening around the world, what do researchers do, and what happens in technology. And it was in the same edition. And when you see Mozart compared to the goldfish, it's like, it's got to blow your mind. It's got to tell you, if you're ever tempted to enter a time machine, and so you can live anywhere, don't ever go into the past, okay? Because it was awful for everybody, even if you ended up as the 0.0001%, because we just didn't have access to the knowledge, the technology.
All right, so life improvements in life expectancy, number one. Number two. What's number two on your list?
The other thing that has improved in a way that almost no one believes, because it has been so dramatic, is poverty, and specifically extreme poverty. And, you know, extreme poverty, when we measure that historically, basically meant that enough to sustain yourself and live to see another day. But today we're talking about around $1.9 a day, adjusted for purchasing power and local prices. And when economic historians try to project that back in history, it seems like 200 years ago, around 90% of the world population lived in extreme poverty. 90%, which means that even in the richest parts of the world, a majority lived in extreme poverty back then. And that started to decline with the Industrial Revolution, because suddenly people could produce more. They had better access to machines and a larger market. So we abolished extreme poverty in rich countries. But now what's happened in the last 50 years is that we are doing the same thing in low and middle income countries. So it's declined from 90%, around 90%, to 9% today. that's how far we've gone. It used to be that one out of 10 people was not living in extreme poverty. Today, less than one out of 10 live in extreme poverty. And it has been fastest in the last 25 years. So around 130,000 people have been lifted out of extreme poverty every day over the last 25 years. That is the greatest story of our time.
So I, you know, I produced this film with Arthur Brooks where we talk a lot about this. It's very similar, some very similar themes. And one of the things that I'm curious about is what percentage of the transformation of the past 25 years comes from two places, China and India. And, you know, is that special to those areas? And does that open up, is that part of what's going on with our sort of broken discourse around China today? So you have this rise of China and wealth in China. And coming back to our earlier conversation, part of the conversation, it's kind of easy to sell, as President Trump does, this idea that they've been ripping us off somehow, that we've been, that Americans have been getting stolen from by the Chinese. And unpack that for me, because I think that one of the things that we often run into when we say, look at how much incredible poverty has been reduced worldwide, sometimes people will say, well, that's just because we've shipped all of our wealth to these poor countries like China and India. And now, you know, Appalachia's poor and the Chinese are rich. And it's this sort of, can you disentangle that for someone that might come to this and have that reaction?
Yeah. That's an important issue that we have to divide into two different segments in a way. The first one being, so how much is this China and India partly? And the other one is why? Have they been cheating? Have they been taking our wealth? First of all, China is the major place when we look at it in quantity, the number of people who've been lifted out of extreme poverty. And if you include India, that's the majority of people. But the thing is, if you remove them from the equation, it doesn't look that different around the world in low and middle income countries. It's just that they are huge. India and China, that's 2.6 billion people. So when that happens there, that means that you'll see them in the charts, more people there than when the same thing happens in Peru, or when it happens in Vietnam, or when it happens in Bangladesh or Cambodia, that just reduced extreme poverty by half in around a decade. So basically, every country that has begun to integrate into the global economy and begun to open up to a certain extent their economies, they've seen this incredibly rapid progress. But India and China is bigger, so they will be more represented in terms of numbers. When it comes to, so why is this? Has China ripped us off? Well, in that case, you might say the same thing about Bangladesh. It's just that because they've seen the same progress in the last 15 years, but they're not as big, so we don't think of them like that. I think this whole sort of Trumpian narrative about how they ripped us off, this is just an old version of the zero-sum game. You think that if someone else is successful, it's because they took it from you. And that's wrong. That's not what happened there. Obviously, China has been sort of stealing intellectual property, and they've been trying to rip us off, just like Sweden did, and just like the United States did when it was trading with England and France 200 years ago and sort of starting to try to steal their intellectual property. But that's just a tiny part of it. The major thing is that people moved from the countryside. They had more agricultural property. They moved into factories where they could produce much more, and therefore they could also earn more. And then what happened was that they could export some of it to us, and that helped them because it gave them a larger market and more export income. But it also helped us in lots of different ways. It helped Sweden, it helped the United States, because we could then buy things that didn't add as much value as other things that we could start doing when we moved labor and capital into those sectors. So take, for example, some people complain about, so why does Apple produce all their iPhones in China? Shouldn't we have those jobs here instead? Shouldn't we have those factories there? Well, yeah, we could do that, but we would lose out big time, because then we would have more people employed in sectors where we didn't add much value. If you look at one iPhone, the latest data I saw was that an iPhone which sells at, say, $650, China and Chinese workers, they get $8.5 out of that. It's like 1.5% of that iPhone ends up with those workers. We think it's big because the factories are big and there are lots of Chinese, but almost all the value ends up in the US and certain other sectors as well, where we have the design, where we have the marketing, where we have the distribution, where we have the retail, where we have the programming, where we have the innovation. And that's how you become rich, by constantly shedding work, routine work that you that doesn't add much value, and instead climb up the value chain so that you produce more. It doesn't look as romantic to those who are sort of manufacturing nostalgics like Donald Trump, who think that we need people in overalls in factories and dirty hands and doing real work. But that's not where the real value is being added.
So I want to, before we move on to number three, I want to push into that, because I think when someone hears that value equation the way you've just laid it out, I think it's that in and of itself is pretty can be pretty counterintuitive. So what do you mean by value? Because I think there's a couple ways to think about that word. If you say, well, the value of a human life is there's just, you know, there's only one. There's like people have value as a person, and the, you know, an American has no more value than a Chinese worker. So you're saying that all these Chinese, there's all these Chinese workers and they're not any adding any value. That sounds, that's making me feel gross. I don't like what you're saying there. So help me understand. Yeah. Because obviously you're not judging their worth as a person.
Yeah.
But no. Help me if I'm coming to the table with no sense of sort of subjective economic value or how it fits in the process, because it's hard to get a sense of that inside of one product in particular, like an example like the iPhone, I think makes it that much harder, because we understand, oh, I go to the Apple store and I buy an iPhone for $650 or more. The value of the individual components are harder for me to get my head around. So how do you explain, lay that out for me a little bit more detail?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And human value is something else than the exchange value that we're getting on the market for the product that we're grading and handing over to someone else. So what I mean by value here is, at the margin, what do you add here that others are willing to pay for? So it's basically, it's about market exchange. It's about compared to everything else that you could be doing and everything else that everybody else could be doing. What you do right now, does that add something that then others would pay much more for or much less for? So those Chinese workers are working incredibly hard, probably much harder than you and I are working. But it's also the case that another 200 million Chinese could do that work, and they could enter that sector if there was a lack of workers doing precisely those things. So it's not that that individual going into that market would make something, would produce something that you and I or another purchaser of an Apple iPhone would think, now we're going to have to pay more to get exactly this kind of thing.
I think the one, sometimes it's easier to think about, why would a janitor who's doing perfectly important work, it's important to have it be clean and it's help for health and sanitation, but why would a janitor get paid less than a doctor? They're both human beings. They're both, they might work the same amount of hours in their day. But obviously a doctor gets paid more. And what's the answer to that? I'm sort of asking, like, it's the labor theory of value problem, because I feel like that's one of the other underlying things that, as we grapple with the future and with progress, that labor theory of value kind of lingers around like a zombie, sort of grabbing us and trying to eat our brains. So how should I think about that?
Well, you know, I have a doctor friend who recently, he had a janitor coming to his place and helping him and his wife to coming twice a week to help them to clean the place up, doing great work, but she had to move. So they didn't have anyone there to help them with that. So what did they do? Well, that doctor could on Sunday mornings do the same work, not as well, but could do it okay. So in a way that didn't make the place look like a total mess, but that janitor, if the doctor would have suddenly become sick and couldn't go to hospital, that janitor couldn't enter that hospital and produce 1% of the kind of care that was needed to do surgery, for example, because that takes a much more specific education, and it takes a much longer practice to do something like that. There are fewer, therefore, people who could do that kind of thing. And therefore, we pay them more, because we need both things. But if we need a plan B, it's better if I do sort of doing some housework than if I was trying to do some surgery, right? And that's basically it. It's not the number of hours that we're working. It's not how hard we work. It's not conscientiousness. It's not anything like that. It's about, so what are the alternatives? What do you do on the margin when you lose this kind of worker? Well, then you're going to have to get someone else to do it. And how many could do somewhat similar? Then it's more difficult to get the surgeon.
The progress for poverty in America look like over this time frame, before we move on from the change in poverty? Because I think that that's the lingering last question is, okay, so we've had this global increase in poverty in Bangladesh and sub-Saharan Africa and East Asia and all over the place, and that's great. But I care more about getting a cut on my pinky finger than I do about people all over the world, as Adam, to paraphrase Adam Smith. And so what's happening here? Like, the West, first world. What's been happening for poverty in the first world? But I mean, America in particular.
Yeah. Well, if you're going that far back, like 200 years in the whole Industrial Revolution, we've reduced it from around 50% to almost nothing when it comes to real extreme poverty. Now what's happened is that we're starting to measure relative poverty instead, or other higher poverty lines. And then nothing much has happened in the last 40 years or so when it comes to poverty. It goes a little bit up and a little bit down, but that's because we're measuring people who are often at the lowest, the bottom of the rung. The bigger discussion is that we're often talking about that there's been a general stagnation and income stagnation. Nothing has really happened for most people most workers since 1970 or so. And there are two problems with that perspective on things. The first one is that mostly this is about fairly labor-intense manufacturing jobs, often in the so-called Rust Belt. Why did that happen? Why did we see more stagnation since then? Well, partly because we've saw such a radical, dramatic increase in wages after the Second World War until the 1970s. And that increase was much faster than productivity increased, which meant that people got for jobs that weren't that heavily specified, wasn't very different from what someone else in any kind of manufacturing jobs could be doing. Partly because we had trade unions who pushed up wages, partly because we had almost a monopoly situation for those businesses. So they just didn't care about their productivity. And they could just keep workers happy by paying them more. So the United States just took off when it comes to wages. That started to create the rust in the Rust Belt. And the Rust Belt lost more jobs between 1960 and 1980 than after 1980, before we saw this globalization, more competition and so on, for the simple fact that wages increased too fast until the 1970s. So it was not Japan or China, it was in other US states, in southern states, where they had more right to work laws and things like that, they could produce much cheaper and they didn't get those extreme wages. So they started to lose out there. They had to put an end to that radical increase in wages. Otherwise, the US would have been completely deindustrialized by now, because it was a very short period in US history when Europe was completely destroyed after the Second World War. Nobody could produce anything, but they wanted to buy everything. The moment Europe got back on its feet, that was no longer possible, but we still had those high wages in the US. So there had to be more moderation afterwards. The other thing is that even that is not the whole story. Because often when we talk about general wage stagnation since the 70s, we only talk about dollars and cents, because that's easy to measure. But most of the increase since then has been in non-monetary compensation. We've seen more spent on health insurance, on pension benefits, on other non-monetary benefits. And if you include all of that, the average wage has increased by something like 60% since then. So we might have wanted more than that, but it's not stagnation.
So basically, the the tide has been rising for more or less just about everybody over the past 30, 40 years. We haven't seen, that's what you're saying the data shows, even at the bottom rung of the economic ladder in the US, people still, if no one's going down, it's kind of hard to argue that those people over there across the sea stole from us. It's like, well, they got richer and we got richer, so how did that happen? All right, number three. What's number three on the 10 reasons to be optimistic?
Well, I would add then, well, where do we go from there? I'd say literacy, which is kind of a precondition for everything else, because that makes it possible for you to get the education, the knowledge that you need, and to communicate with others so that we can accumulate more ideas and more knowledge. And well, if you take a really long perspective, 200 years around the world, we had around 12% who were literate 200 years ago. They could read and write. So 88% couldn't. Today, it's the other way around. It's around 12% of adults who cannot read and write. And
globally.
Obviously, globally. And most dramatically in the youngest generation, almost every region is getting close to 100% of children in schools, rather than going to out into the crop fields in the morning.
It's hard to argue with that. So, no, okay, number four.
We could take something like hunger, which is, it's close to all of these things. And I mentioned hunger before, but this is the, I mean, it used to be, chronic undernourishment used to be so, such a chronic fact about the world. So it's part of our biological regiment. It's fairly new that we're able to eat enough. And that's why we eat too much as well. But historically, the old, it's been estimated that 200 years ago, some 20% of people in the richest countries, in England and France, they couldn't work at all. I mean, they didn't get enough nutrition so that they could do a day's work and get the wages or the income that they needed to do that work. So they were stuck in a nutritional trap, even in the richest countries. And today we're down to around 10% around the world in chronic undernourishment because of amazing improvements in agricultural productivity, because of many incremental changes in better crops, better machines, better irrigation systems, and so on. And also some heroes like Norman Borlaug, the agronomist who created better high-yielding wheat so that countries and implemented it large scale in countries like Mexico, India, and Pakistan. And it's been estimated that he probably saved the lives of a billion people because of this.
Here's a surprising one, and I'm curious to if this year marks a dip in your book is violence at number five. It's in your, I've pulled up your table of contents so I can keep track. So what's happened with violence? Because if you watch the news, it seems like the world's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, no, it looks like it, definitely. But it always looked like that, you know, for the last 30 years, Americans have said on average that crime has increased every year, even though it was reduced every year during that period of time. So it's like it's on our screens and it's in social media and it's on cable all the time. And it's the most scary thing we can think of. And yet the homicide rate has been almost halved in 30 years. So if you weren't panicked about crime 30 years ago, I don't think you should be now. Now we're seeing another kind of violence and the kind of rioting that takes place in certain places. But an interesting fact is that people who are close to that violence and to that rioting think that it's much less dramatic than people who are far away. And when you look at polls, so why? What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that media generally is an amplifier of everything that's bad and dramatic. So if there's a fire anywhere, we're going to think of that place like it's a place on fire. Whereas if you're there, you notice that, yeah, that was on fire for like 5 minutes. And that's when all the media was there. I will never forget an image from Donald Trump's inauguration in DC, where all the journalists were there waiting for violence and drama and action. 4 years ago, and nothing much happened. But at some point, a bag of trash fell over, and someone tried to lit it up. So there was this tiny, tiny fire. And what happened then was that all the journalists and cameramen, photographers, they gathered around taking pictures at this one place over the whole of Washington, D.C. to try to portray that something dramatic happened. And once you've seen that, it cannot be unseen, because that's how the media works always.
It is, this might be a tangent, though it's an important one, which is, the media, I've started to say news media, and more broadly, there's a lot of feedback loops that sort of add up to kind of a fear industrial complex, that there's and maybe it's just like you said earlier in our conversation, we're sort of evolved, our survival instincts make us really dialed in to threats. So of course, there's going to be a market response to that psychological desire, and it's going to be a media that's sort of cravenly, dishonestly committed to over dramatizing even the slightest flipped over trash can into a mass revolt or a horrible catastrophe. Have you noticed a change though over your career in the way media portrays the catastrophizing? It does feel like it's gotten more extreme, but maybe it's just gotten more because of all of our screens and all of our data feeds. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I've got the feeling that it's getting more and worse, but I think my feeling is wrong because I think it's just that I'm being attacked from all sides constantly with information about it. And now it's not just sort of reading the newspaper in the morning and the evening news. Now it's social media as well. And it's my friends and it's Twitter and constantly sending me information about everything that's gone wrong somewhere. And, I think we were mentally prepared for it in another way before we had social media specifically, because then it was the evening news, and then we were like, okay, now I'm prepared for my 20 minutes of death, horror, violence, and disaster. And we lean back and look at it, and then, okay, that's bad, it's awful, and then we went on with our lives. And we
watch I Love Lucy, enough.
Quite right. And now when we try to watch that, we're being interrupted by our cell phone telling us that, look, Flash, something awful happened there and someone was killed there and there's a riot over there. And I think that it's more, but it's happening when we're not mentally prepared for it. It's happening in our social media flows when we're like, okay, what's the latest joke, or someone got a new job or got married, and then it's like, and someone was stabbed and someone was blown to pieces in Yemen. It's like it feels like it's everywhere. It's eating us up from all sides. And that's terrible because we can't handle that psychologically. I think perhaps we should go back to some, or learn to handle our flows in a way so that we sort of step into that particular account when we want the disaster and the news, and in another one when we want to look at what our friends are doing rather than mixing it all up.
The I think one of the sources of catastrophizing that's in our feeds to the max is the environment, which is another one that's on your list. So it's become a meme to say that we're on the verge of catastrophe in 12 years, or I guess maybe now it's 10 years, that life as we know it is under an extinction level type of threat. And I know kids to very young ages are being told this in school, and they have these levels of anxiety that we've never seen before. But you've got it on your list of reasons to feel excited about the future, to be optimistic. So what do I have to be optimistic about in the environment? I thought we were all about to either drown in a hurricane or burn in a fire or something.
Yeah, that's what my kids tell me as well when they come home from school every day, that everything is falling to pieces. And the reason why I'm an optimist is that I heard the same thing back in school. But back then there were other environmental issues that they told me would destroy the planet. And the great fact is that that didn't happen. We dealt with those problems. We solved those problems. It's, you know, the River Thames in London was declared biologically dead in the 1950s. Now it's teeming with life. And now it's even got the short-snouted seahorse back, which is a very cute seahorse. And the researchers even kept it a secret when they realized, because people wanted to kidnap it for their aquariums. but it's an interesting thing because it only makes an appearance when there's very little pollution. And it's the same thing with rivers and lakes throughout the Western world. They used to catch fire because there was so much trash and pollution in them. Now it's safe to swim in them. The six traditional great pollutants have been reduced from the 1970s by more than 75% in the rich world. The forests are growing all over the rich world nowadays. We thought we would run out of them. We've had a reduction of oil spills in the oceans by some 95%. All those things that I thought would kill us and the planet back then, we dealt with it because we learned about the problems, we got richer, and we let the researchers and engineers loose to come up with new solutions to them. And if we could do it back then, I don't understand why we wouldn't be able to do it now.
The there's two, these are again very Julian Simon things. There's two examples that are kind of related that I find so interesting and funny for different reasons. So one that was it Rockefeller and Standard Oil? You know, they had this trash, right, that they used to dump in the rivers because there was no use for it whatsoever during the production of kerosene lamps. And they had a name for this trash. It was called gasoline. They would just dump it in the river because they had no use for this gasoline. We've got this kerosene that we use in our lamps. It's a byproduct. It's just waste. So, you know, that's one part of the process, is that we turn trash into treasure all the time. And then another one is, you know, I'm being lit by this $80 light from Amazon, and it's composed of LEDs. And my understanding is, and these, I can see them right there, they're white. My understanding is it was believed that white LED light was impossible. The physicists said, no, it's, you cannot produce white light with LED technology. And some Joe Blow tinkerer didn't know that it was impossible, and he invented white LEDs. And so that sort of the way that we constantly like transform things that were either impossible or that were waste and turn them into value or treasure or dump something new just seems, it just, history is just littered with these examples. But people say, well, that's all well and good, but carbon is different. Climate change through CO2 emissions is different. Do they have a point? How do you deal with this issue of, you know, carbon dioxide and its impact on the greenhouse effect? And I know no one says the greenhouse effect anymore, but I guess I'm older. I'm 43. So it used to be the greenhouse.
That's what effect. We learned in kindergarten.
Yeah. But you know, what's your response to people who say, yeah, you know, Johan, I get it. That's the way it used to be, but this time is different. This is the end. Yeah. This is the real deal this time. It's, I know we said it was an ice age before, but now we're right this time.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what we've heard about every single pollutant. When we've dealt with the other ones, there's always, yeah, but this one is different. And in a way, yes, it has been different with carbon dioxide because that has kept on increasing and, all over the world, even though the traditional local pollutants have been reduced quickly. But does that make it different in the long run? I'm not so sure, because the thing is, we've constantly seen an increase in energy efficiency. It's improving our ways of doing more with less. We've reduced energy intensity by some 2% a year because of the traditional incremental change and improvement in all our products and in our transportation and energy systems. And that doesn't even count the fact that we're starting to use greener technologies that doesn't know without fossil fuels. And obviously that is coming online quicker than anybody would have expected. We're seeing dramatic decline in the cost of solar. We're seeing perhaps the fourth generation nuclear. We are seeing ways of sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere artificially, like trees, just better because they take out much more from
like
the atmosphere.
Trees, and it's just better.
Yeah. And they might not look as nice, but they don't take as much land area because, you know, trees, they take up a lot of land that we need for other things as well. And it's coming down in price rapidly, and it's still too expensive to use it everywhere. But what do you do when something is too expensive? Well, you want more innovation so that it comes down more in price and more purchasing power so that you can afford it in more places.
So have you had a chance to talk to your fellow Swede, young Greta Thunberg, about her nerves about the future?
I think I actually might have seen her on a bicycle today. We met like two ships in the night. And I kind of nodded because I thought it was someone I knew. And it's like, and she nodded back in an awkward way. No, but we're engaged in a long distance debate about these things, because the problem with her perspective, and I've got to say that I respect her, and I think she is an amazing promoter of her perspective globally, and I've rarely seen the like of that. The problem is that she's saying that, look, it was all a mistake. The whole industrial civilization based on fossil fuels, it has ruined our world. It has stolen my childhood, basically. That's not quite true. It's more accurate to say that fossil fuels gave you a childhood, because before we learned how to increase our ability to use power through fossil fuels, we had a 50% of children died before adolescence. And so it was not that our sort of grandparents and grand-grandparents used these power sources because they were evil and wanted to ruin our childhood. They wanted to save our lives and gave us food on the table. And that created certain problems once they've saved more lives, and then we're going to have to deal with that. But just abolishing it, stopping it, would have been a nightmare, not just because we couldn't produce food and wealth to the extent that we have, but also because we wouldn't have been able to deal with problems like climate change, for example. You know, when you look at climate-related natural disasters, the risk of dying in one has been reduced by around 95% since the 1960s.
Wow.
And why is that? It's since the 1960s. And it's not because the global warming isn't happening, because it is happening. It's not that we have much fewer natural disasters, because we don't. It's because of wealth, because of technology, because that has bought us the ability to deal with it in certain ways, to build in better ways, to deal with rising sea levels, to improve our ways of dealing with accidents, health problems, concerns. So all of those things combined, droughts, extreme temperatures, storms, and so on, reduced by 95% in the risk of dying from it. So had we stopped all our use of fossil fuels in 1960, yeah, we would have had a bit less global warming than we do today. And yet, around 500,000 people more would have died from climate-related natural disasters. So it tells you that...
Was that a 500,000 or a 500,000,000, did you just say?
Half a million. Half a million. Let's not exaggerate here.
At these scales, it's hard to say.
But that's a lot of people. So 500,000 people would have died extra every year because of climate-related disasters.
Every year.
So that tells you that shutting things down, panicking, and thinking like, let's just stop doing this, would have been a nightmare. It would have been a nightmare for health and wealth and hunger and so on. But it would also have been a nightmare when it comes to our ability to deal with the consequences of climate change. So that tells me that Greta is, I think she's honest and I understand her passion, but I think if she got everybody to panic and shut everything down, it would sacrifice lots of people and children.
I think that it's an interesting challenge we face now, is because how do you think about do you think we're going to overcome our problems of discourse when it comes to this? Because the discourse around these issues is so broken and so catastrophic and so irrational, and in some cases very intentionally irrational, because it's like, no, we have to generate fear in order to bring action, but it seems like there's just as much of a counter reaction to that as anything else. Do you think we're just gonna invent our way out of this problem and it's gonna be fine? Here's the way I think about it. Either we're gonna tech our way out. You know, we're gonna invent the things that you're talking about. They're gonna keep getting better. Solar, carbon capture, all this stuff, and it's going to not be a problem. And 50 years from now, it'll be like, hey, everything's going just fine. Or it seems like we're kind of screwed in every other path, because if it's as bad as they're saying and we can't tech our way out, it doesn't seem like we can politics our way out. there's not really a lot of, like, the French, if the French can't increase the gas tax without a revolt, I don't really see how we politics our way out. Like, you know, so is that sort of how you think about it? Like, it's innovation or bust? Or is there another way for me to think about sort of the different paths we might head as a society?
No, I think you basically summed it up. I would not look to the capitals and our political leaders for the solution to this, because they'll get stuck in that angry, broken partisanship on every issue. And when they do stuff, unfortunately, they often end up in picking one favorite solution that they happen to like for one or another reason. And I rarely understand why, because it's often almost, it's more like a, like they have a personal interest, almost an aesthetic one. I mean, for some reason, the right seems to like nuclear power and the left seems to like wind power. And then they want to subsidize their own version of it, rather than just saying, we have no idea. Look, we're politicians. We're good at getting votes and raising funds. I have no idea about the next green technology. So let's look at things like sort of putting a price on carbon rather than taxing incomes, and then leave this to the experts, the scientists, the entrepreneurs, the consumers, and let's see what you come up with. Because this, you know, it's difficult enough to pick winners in business and economics to sort of subsidize your favorite business, but doing it in green technology to understand what's going to work 50 years hence, that's just impossible.
So we've got a couple more on the list before we wrap out with a little discussion about the future Swedenification, the Scandinave America that lies before us. So you said, you know, you touched, your number two in your book is sanitation. So tell me why sanitation should be on the list of excitement for the future. It doesn't seem, it's like, is that a future thing? That doesn't seem like a future thing. Why is that in a book about the future?
Yeah, it's because we take it for granted, right? It's not that exciting. it's we got it, that's it. But even the greatest, most powerful people didn't once upon a time. And I share the story in the book about the great emperor of the Holy Roman Emperor around 1,000 years ago. In Erfurt, he held court for all the princes and the princesses and the bishops of his whole empire, and they had everything, the best food that the empire could produce and the best music, probably, with the greatest troubadours, but they just didn't have sanitation and water closets and things like that, so you would just have to relieve yourself in a cupboard, and then all of the stuff ended up beneath the floor in the great hall. Which it's not too bad, at least if you don't have a strong sense of smell or something like that, unless they have done a lousy work on the floor. And this day, this evening, it turned out that they had. So the floor began to buckle and give way in certain places, and suddenly the whole floor collapsed. And in the history books, we noticed that some of the great princes of the empire, they died that evening because they drowned in excrement. And that that tells you something about the history of why sanitation is important. But obviously, even in our day and age, in non-industrialized, in poor countries, separating the place where you relieve yourself from where you get water for hygiene and for drinking. If you don't do that, that's one of the major causes of illness and of death. So sanitation is one of the reasons why we're here, why we are alive, why we have life expectancy around 80 years.
You put a quality on your list at number 9. So what do you mean? Because I only get my news from my feed, and I'm told constantly that things are more unequal than ever before. So what is this? How could you possibly say equality is a reason to be optimistic? I would think the opposite is true based on watching the news.
Yeah, I talk in that chapter about equality before the law, about equal rights. You don't have to go further back in time than the early 1900s, and no country gave equal rights to women, to ethnic and religious minorities when it comes to their ability to proceed in society, in education, in careers, voting, standing for public office, and so on. It began to grow during the Enlightenment and after the Industrial Revolution and with the creation of liberal democracies, but it's a very, very new phenomena, and it's now spreading around the world in a larger extent. So when it comes to equality of rights, we live in the era when that is beginning to become practice around the world. But even when it comes to equality in material terms, it's fascinating to look at this from a global perspective, because we always think that everything, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. But yes, but we have just reduced extreme poverty from almost 40% in 1990 to less than 10% today. And that means that for the first time, we have actually reduced global inequality for the first time since the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution started to create inequality, because before that, we were all equally poor, basically. We all lived in dirt and hunger. And then suddenly a few countries took off during the Industrial Revolution and got very rich, increased their wealth 20-fold. And that created a very unequal world, because not everybody got there. Now they are catching up. And since around the turn of the millennium, we've seen, for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, a modest decline in global inequality, materially speaking.
One of the things that I want, two writers, economists that I like a lot, Don Boudreau and Mark Perry from GMU and AEI, like to write about the narrowing of inequality in basic material terms. And they point to things like, you know, Bill Gates uses the same phone as I do. And, you know, we've all got air conditioning now in the United States, and most people have a car, and many have two, and people have multiple phone, multiple televisions, and, you know, and dishwashers and washing machines, and that there's all these things that make our lives dramatically more convenient, more comfortable, and better. And that if you go back to this halcyon 1960s time, you would really find life to be dramatically worse on a lot of these things that we take for granted. And they are now spread and they're distributed, and you can go to a Best Buy and get things that were unimaginably out of reach for a middle-class worker in 1970. And today they're almost free. And is that happening worldwide? Is that part of the phenomenon? Just like the increasing access to goods and services?
Yeah. No, that's a really important point. And you mentioned two great economists, and I've learned a lot specifically from Don Boudreau about these things. And because this is the major thing that's happening, every kind of inequality is the in free market societies is the result of some people getting ahead, creating stuff and getting stuff. When they do it on a large scale, it becomes a routine matter of routine production, and it comes down in price so that we can all use it eventually. We can see that in every sphere. We can see that when it comes to drugs that we're using in our hospitals, incredibly costly, impossible to use. But because they're being used in some parts of the US healthcare system, for example, 5 years later, we can even use them in Sweden because it's come down in price afterwards. So the rich are basically suckers. They're wasting lots of money on luxury goods, drugs, cell phones, stuff that no one can afford. And those resources are being used to produce it better and cheaper so that the middle classes can use them eventually. But this is the case when it comes to every indicator of human progress. I find it incredibly fascinating to look at things like the poorest countries who haven't made economic progress. What about them? What has happened there? There are a few. A country like Haiti isn't really that much richer than they were 60 years ago. So, and that's an exception. It's one of the few exceptions. But how do they live there compared to 60 years ago? Well, life expectancy has increased by 21 years. Infant mortality has been reduced by 3/4 in Haiti, because the things that they need to improve health and certain technologies and to make sure that they produce food and have a supply chain that functions and make it all the way to the shop and to the home, they have been produced elsewhere in richer countries that got richer, and then they've come down in price, and vaccines and drugs and power sources and so on have come down in price to the extent that even countries that haven't got richer, they can now afford it to improve life expectancy and reduce infant mortality there.
I've thought that we should maybe probably the most humanitarian thing that that America could do as a government, as a region to help Haiti is open the doors and say, come in. I've been through the Midwest. There's a lot of space. Just come here. We got great laws. We've got, it works pretty well for all of our problems. You're going to do great. And it's and most of the Haitian immigrants I've met in the United States are, you know, they are driven. They build lives for themselves, like every immigrant group in this country. And it just seems like the thing that Haitians maybe need is just some suitcases.
And visas. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so. Not an easy case to make these days, but there's not that many of them. We've got so much room. Just come on in. We'll turn the island into a resort hotel.
And it's still the case that around 2/3 of your income is dependent on not who you are, not your education or your skills. It's dependent on where you happen to be born in the world. If you're born without the institutions that create decent, open free market societies, and with others who have a reasonable education, access to technology and so on, you're rich. If you don't, you're not. So making sure that more people could move to places where that exists, that's what economists often talk about as trillion-dollar bills on the pavement, because it's like the easiest way to improve the world's wealth.
I think we've covered everything down to number 10. So in your book, number 10, the number 10 reason for being optimistic about the future is the next generation. And you might have to try to convince me on this one. So why should the next generation make me feel good about progress? Why should I look forward? I don't know. I see a lot of complaints about safe spaces and anxiety and depression and kids that don't seem to understand that you're, you know, you come out of school and you get a job and it's not supposed to necessarily make you happy. You're supposed to do a good job at it in exchange for pay. And, you know, maybe I'm getting to be like a grumpy middle-aged man now. And it's just, I'm letting my grumpiness wear on my sleeve, but why should I'm playing this up. I don't feel quite this grumpy, but make the case for the kids. Cause I don't know, are the kids all right?
We're all becoming grumpy middle-aged eventually. You know, that's what Douglas Adams, who wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he talked about it in the context of technology, but also of culture, that everything that's in the world when you were born, it's the natural order of things. That's the way everything should be like. Then everything that happens between, say, 15 and 30, it's kind of interesting and exciting, and you could probably make a career out of it. Everything that happens after you're 30 is against the natural order of things, and it's a sign that the world is going to the dogs. And we are all getting there eventually. It's just a matter of, can we somewhat moderate that inner grumpy man? When I look at the next generation, obviously I can see that they're not paying attention to the important stuff, the things that I care about mostly. And that's what my father thought about me as well, obviously, and onwards back in time. What we do know is that they're getting a better and a longer education than ever before. Child labor is being abolished around the world. They are better connected to others and their ideas and their ambitions and technologies and so on. So they stand a better chance of accumulating new knowledge and innovate new great things than ever. So all that's good. When you talk about bad kids at the university and they just want safe spaces and they don't want to listen to their opponents, yeah, that's bad. But how many are they? Are we listening to the radical fringe here a little bit? Could it be that there's an exhausted majority everywhere out there? And what did that radical fringe do 50 years ago? They blew up bombs instead and try to start civil wars. So it might just be that we, you know, the belief in the good old days is mostly about a bad memory.
I think that's a really good perspective, because I think is there anything that shakes your optimism? Is there anything that you feel where you know, there might be signs of regress, and it might not be, maybe it's not material, maybe it's spiritual or moral or in terms of character or community, or it does feel like one thing that globalization and freedom to move and freedom to explore things does do is it often, you know, we move away from our communities. I grew up in the Northeast and now I live in Texas, and I moved down here for reasons and I'm happy with it, but I no longer am there with my family, and that's a real cost to me. And I feel that I'm Italian, and so I'm really into that. But I'm trying to pull some
desperately.
Yeah, is there anything that you look at and say, well, that is something that we're going to overcome perhaps, but we're struggling with it?
I think we're struggling with that. I think that's an important point, but I think we've struggled with that for a very long time. You know, some of my ancestors, or at least their relatives, moved to the US from Sweden, 1 million of them. The difference was that once they did, they knew that they would never, ever meet with their friends and family again. They might send letters back and forth a little bit, but nothing more. And now when you move to even the other side of the globe, you can be in constant real-time contact. And yeah, that's something. And you build new communities, because we are social animals. We need to build those new communities and families and connections again. And it is a challenge, and it's always been a challenge. But now we have plenty of tools to make that function in a better way. One thing that does worry me a bit is that it takes some time for us to get used to those tools and how to use them in various ways. And one of the things that we talked about earlier, or at least connected to it, is that I think that we might once in a while build our own tribes and we might think that everybody else belongs to an enemy tribe and that we have to fight against them, and there are enemies. We haven't learned how to process information about the world yet through social media. We scare ourselves to death by constantly looking at the worst things that have happened. Have you thought about the fact that you spent so much time being angry with someone that you didn't even know existed 5 minutes ago?
Right.
because someone you know on Twitter retweeted, "Look at this awful guy in a city that you've never heard of who said something awful. Isn't that crazy? Has the whole world gone mad?" No, it's just that people were crazy before as well, but they weren't in your face and you never heard about it. We haven't learned how to deal with that, with people who are not of our tribe, but they're in your face. And that's going to take some time and some hard work.
We've had a long conversation, and I can't possibly do justice to what I teased you a bit at the top, which is about the future of Sweden, this our Swedish American future. But I'm gonna try to at least get a little bit. So you know for my good friend Jim Tusty worked with you on a film about Sweden, and which is really, you just got to watch that movie and you'll get the picture. But as we, you know, we're gearing up for a presidential election, Bernie Sanders he sort of looms in the background of this election, at least as far as what seems like perhaps the likely outcome of Joe Biden becoming elected. And so we've heard a lot about democratic socialism in America, more than ever in my lifetime. People say, well, all I'm really talking about is being more like Sweden or Norway or Scandinavia. And then they list off a bunch of policies that don't sound a lot like Sweden, Norway or Scandinavia. So can you just summarize for those of us that are in America contemplating how to think about Sweden and have never been there? You know, what exactly are people talking about? Like what is and isn't the Swedish system from an American perspective?
Well, you know, when Swedish social democrats, who happen to be in government right now, when they look at US policies, they think that, look, that Bernie Sanders guy is crazy. What is he up to? The most successful Swedish social democratic prime minister in the modern era, Göran Persson, he explained emphatically that I would never call myself a socialist. Why not? Well, you become confused with too many crazies. That's what happens. And the difference is that in Sweden, we have experienced something that's at least close to socialism, whereas no Americans have. So we've learned the lesson that that's not the way to do it. And that was back in the 1970s and 1980s. It didn't become socialism because we never socialized the means of production, but we increased taxes and spending and regulation like Bernie Sanders would like to do now. And that the result, and this is what the rest of the world remembers about us, that look, we were almost socialists and we were still quite successful, right? We didn't starve, we didn't end up with labor camps like every other socialist experiment, but it was like that old joke, how do you end up with a small fortune? Well, you start with a large fortune and then you waste most of it. And then you end up there, because this was the period in time when Sweden began to lag behind other countries, when we didn't create a single net job in the private sector for 40 years.
And For four decades,
not a single net job in the private sector. And it ended in a terrible financial crisis in the early 1990s, when those policies were summarized by one spectator as perverse, unsustainable, absurd. And that was the Social Democratic Minister of Finance at that time. So what happened since was that Sweden got back to what we used to do before the 1970s, having a very open economy with fierce competition, with free trade, with more sustainable welfare systems, reforming social security, implementing school voucher systems to improve education, and generally becoming more welcoming towards entrepreneurship and business. And that's where we are now. That's why Sweden have again now been more successful than other industrialized countries.
The one of the biggest things that, that it's like a meme is this idea that the wealthy in America don't pay their fair share. And I think there's some people for whom who receive benefits and subsidies from the government for whom that's a reasonable criticism. But on the whole, what does it look like to compare the way the American government funds itself, who pays for American public services versus Sweden, yeah, who pays for Swedish public services? I'm teeing this up for you.
thank you.
I think Americans need to hear this stuff because it's like we don't, nobody knows it.
This is incredibly important because the Social Democrats in Sweden learned early on that you can have a situation where you get the rich to pay for everything, or you can have a big government. You can't have both. Because if you have a big government and try to make the rich pay for it all, the rich and the big businesses, then you'll ruin those businesses and you'll make sure that you won't get any entrepreneurship in the long run. So you have to make that decision. So if you absurdly, this is not what Bernie Sanders or Warren would assume about Sweden, but our tax system is less progressive than the American one. The US top 10% the 10% richest, they pay around 45% of the income taxes in the US. In Sweden, top 10 pay around 25% of income taxes. So if you don't think that the American rich pay their fair share, you really don't want to be like Sweden. And the thing is, what we've done in Sweden, and this is, it's not something that I'm proud of, but this is what you've got to do if you want all those free services. Well, you've got to make sure that the poor and the middle classes pay for their own services. So we fund our tax system mostly on, when it comes to income taxes, based on a regional income tax, which is a flat tax, where the rich and the poor pay the same percentage. And then we also have a VAT at 25% for most goods, where the rich and the poor pay exactly the same amount when they buy something. So it's more focused on poor, the poor and the middle classes, because as Swedish Social Democrats say, the poor are reliable taxpayers. They don't have tax lawyers. I mean, they're not like Donald Trump, able to sort of set off their great profits and incomes through some smart device over there. They pay for it, and they can't put their assets in Monaco or anything like that. They pay for it, and that's the key to the Swedish fairly large and big welfare state. You can have that if everybody pays for their own services.
Is it sustainable in Sweden? Does it seem like the fiscal, because our fiscal outlook seems like it gets worse by the year, and it seems like it's especially bad anytime one party has all the branches of government in the United States. Like when it's Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter if they all have this, if it's like the House, the Senate, and the President are all of the same party, they just take the regulators off that gas pedal and spend as much money as possible to just, I think to just buy their way into re-election. But what does the Swedish sort of fiscal picture look like? Is it sustainable? Are you accumulating more and more debt over time, or does it look pretty good? Are those poor people paying taxes? That's great. Like those reliable poor taxpayers.
Yeah, thank you for your service. Actually, this will sound like fiction to you as an American, but in the last 25 years, the political debate between the left and the right has often been about one side attacking the other for being too fiscally irresponsible, and that you should instead pay off the debt rather than accumulating debt. So there's been an almost self-imposed restraint, and we have a public debt at around 40% of GDP by now in Sweden, which looks pretty good compared to most countries. And that's partly because we learned the lesson in the early 1990s when we had this terrible crisis, and the rest of the world said, we won't fund you in the future if you're this irresponsible. We learned that lesson. Both the left and the right have been very restrained since then. And most importantly, and this is another important lesson, I think, for the US, is that there was a consensus on dealing with the entitlement issue, because this was the most unsustainable area, especially social security, pension benefits, that would just spiral out of control with changing demographics in the long run. So the center-right and the Social Democrats agreed on reforming Social Security and change it from a defined benefit system to a defined contribution system.
So and from a also, pension to a 401k, basically.
Yes, and with some individual accounts, partially privatized as well, so you can pick your own funds there. And this means that the Swedish
system, I can't help but laugh that Sweden partially privatized Social Security. It's just like,
yeah, we're still laughing about it as well. but this means that the Swedish Social Security system cannot go bust. I mean, they could find a way, but it won't, because when growth is lower, when the returns are lower, well, then we reduce the payments automatically. There are equations in the law to make sure that this happens. So it's not really a political issue anymore. It's not like you can buy votes by saying, yeah, we'll give you some more than the others would. And that has given us some self-confidence in Sweden's future, because we know that, yeah, we might not be happy with the benefits we're getting, but we know we're getting some benefits, and we know that it's not in the hands of the politicians. It cannot be changed overnight depending on who's in charge.
There's something I was struck by. I haven't been to Sweden, although I have several close Swedish friends, but I spent some time in Denmark, and I have a small segment of our film with Arthur Brooks, The Pursuit, that is basically like a small version of the story that your film spent, you know, really dives into, but it's Denmark versus Sweden. So it's not the same, but it's a similar story. It sure seems like the cultural homogeneity in Sweden, and in the Scandinavian countries plays a role in the trust that you seem to have, that, you know, these countries are rated high for having high levels of trust. People say, oh, I trust my neighbor. And I saw some studies that are very interesting on when it comes to this social welfare sort of balancing act, which was that when you polled, it might've been Danes, but it might've been Swedes as well. When you polled Swedes about, or Danes about, social welfare programs in terms of other Danes or other Swedes, support was really high. The second you asked if those programs should go towards people of other races or immigrant groups or anyone diverse, anyone that doesn't look like your cousin Sven, I'm sorry if that's maybe offensive, but the poll numbers go right to the same level as it looked like you're running the poll in America. And we're in this very racially and geographically diverse society. So have you thought, I imagine you have grappled with this. What's your take on this? Is that a fair part of the story of the differences between what American sort of social policy can look like and what Sweden and smaller countries like Sweden are able to do? It seems to be like an important part of the puzzle, but I'm hesitant to lean into it too much.
Yeah. No, I think that's, you're definitely onto something, that everybody wants a system where they pay something for themselves, services that they are getting themselves, or people like them. And then it all depends on what like them means, because it could be your cousin, everybody who looks like you, but it could also be well-integrated immigrants from 100 years ago. But new groups definitely arouses this suspicion. They're not like us. They're different. They don't behave like us. Why should we pay for them? And that's been going on in the US and many other societies far longer than homogenous places like Sweden and Denmark. But that's also why we're getting this debate right now. We have these very strong sort of welfare chauvinist parties, in a way, welfare state nationalists, anti-immigrant, and sort of in favor of a generous welfare state at the same time, struggling with these issues. And this is changing our political dynamic right now, and it's very difficult to see where it's going to end up. To me, it tells me that this would be a reason, because there's this strong sense, and that it might spiral out of control into some sort of tribal warfare. It's a reason to perfect what should be the best part of the Swedish and Scandinavian model. The fact that you're actually paying into something for yourself, more of individual accounts and individual responsibility for what you're getting. We did that when it comes to social security. I think we should do that in more, say, parts of our welfare system, so that you actually have to pay into the system and work before you can get any benefits back. And if we have that kind of system, then it doesn't really matter if the others are different, come from elsewhere, look different, because it's not you who are paying for them. They're paying for their own security.
Yeah, it's another example of this this strange thing that to observe major political forces in this country look to Sweden and Norway and Denmark. I'm grouping these countries together. I know there's rivalries between them, but I find it such a it's such an ignorant conversation in the public discourse in the U.S. There's no content to it. It's just like there's some fictional cutout that's called Sweden that's being put up on the wall in some people's offices and like, I'm going to be like that. It's like, well, you drew that. Who was that? I don't know who that is.
Like a Rorschach test. It's like a blob of ink.
It is.
And then everybody gets to say what it looks like.
It's a Viking blob. I heard this term, and I don't know if it applies elsewhere in the region. Janta law.
Yeah.
Is that a thing in Sweden? And if so, what is it for people that have never heard it?
The Janta law, it's an old expression of the law that you shouldn't think yourself being better than anybody else. And definitely you shouldn't show anyone that you think you're better or that you succeeded or anything. You should be humble about yourself. And it's coined by an author. I've got the book over there. It's about a Norwegian village, originally Jante, I think. And to Sandemo, he looked at this as a form of repression and oppression because there's no room for individuality. But I definitely think that this is part of the Scandinavian tradition and definitely of the Swedish one. And actually, I think this is partly the result of us being all farmers. We never had feudalism in Sweden, so we're all sort of small property owning farmers working together in the village, and you work hard, you try not to stand out because the village is successful as long as we stick together against the others who might want to impose feudalism or whatever on us, which means that the eccentric, the individualist, is a little bit of a troublemaker. So you don't want to be too different from the others. You want to blend in. And it's not that different from other very homogenous societies where people are the same, have the same beliefs and traditions. Then the only way to sort of stand out is to move.
I want to end our conversation with just a quick, this is just to get your take on how Sweden has handled the coronavirus. And just like from a headlines perspective, it's now early October. It seemed to me like Sweden was taking the most reasonable public policy course back in March. I wrote like a Facebook post. It was like, this seems like it's a really serious problem, but it seems like Sweden, of all the places, seems to be doing the thing that makes the most sense to me, but I'm not an epidemiologist. What the hell do I know about this? What did Sweden actually do, and how has it fared so far?
Turns out you were right, even though you're not an epidemiologist then. At least I think so. And I think that's the Swedish general impression as well. Well, what Sweden did is not that dramatic. We did what all other liberal democracies intended to do originally when they faced a pandemic, to try to protect the vulnerable, make sure that we have as much social distancing as is possible, but don't shut down societies, transportation, businesses, because that would hurt us even more. It would hurt us more through the economy, unemployment, domestic abuse, mental health issues. And long term, it would hurt us because we'd have fewer resources in the long term for things like healthcare, for example. That's what everybody else said in the planning as well. But then for some reason, once China imposed this drastic authoritarian shutdown of everything, every other country started to imitate that. And that was the strange thing. The strange thing wasn't that Sweden avoided that path. It was that everybody else suddenly turned to the Chinese model. So what Sweden did was implementing a few restrictions, like no public events with more than 50 people, no visits to nursing homes and so on. But apart from that, mostly recommending social distancing, telling people that if you can work from home, do it. If you can avoid that trip or that meeting with friends and relatives, do it. Which meant that we reduced lots of mobility, but giving some space for individual needs, local knowledge, which I think actually might make this more sustainable than where you say that, no, you can't go to even to that dear friend or that funeral or what have you. And the result is that, well, some of these models said that we would by now have 90,000 deaths in Sweden if we did this. Well, they were off by around 85,000 deaths. So it's more than, so it's around almost 6,000 deaths by now. Much, which is awful, but much better than any of the models that they scared us with originally. The model said that around 30 to 40 people would fight over every hospital bed when we had the peak. But we never reached that kind of peak. We always had an excess capacity of around 20% in Sweden. So it seems like we managed to flatten the curve. And so far, we're not back to where everybody else in Europe seems to be right now with a more dramatic second wave, which seems to suggest that they didn't avoid cases and deaths. They merely postponed them.
It's, why do you think Swedish politics and the Swedish people could tolerate the path that was chosen? Because it is weird. I mean, I don't want to believe that every governor and that went for draconian lockdowns is like a wannabe tin pot dictator totalitarian here in the U.S. It's easy to say that in the heat of passion about politics, but I don't think that's actually like a reasonable take on it. I think people like Whitmer in Michigan here in U.S. or Andrew Cuomo, or you name it. I think they were scared. I think they were, they were being risk averse. They didn't want to have blood on their hands or be perceived as that in the eyes of voters. And there was a perceived demand from the public, I think, at some level to do something. And that's, the debate we're having right now in this political, in this election is, well, why didn't the president do more? I'm not sure even what that would have meant. But if you look at Sweden, it's like, well, we should have done less in some sense, like less dramatic, less top down, less authoritarian policies. How did that, like, what is there? Yeah. Is there something in the water? How did this get tolerated? And it was more so in Sweden than in your neighbors too, which I find interesting.
Yeah. No, I don't think that they're sort of tin pot dictators either. I think that when others begin, there was a demand from people. When we're scared, we want the big man, the big government to protect us, and they respond to that. But it's also when everybody else changes course, you always run the risk of being in the wrong. But it's much worse to be the odd man out and be wrong, rather than doing the same mistake as everybody else. And I think that's one of the reasons why every government and most states implemented radical shutdowns, because if you're wrong, at least it's more safe to be wrong in company. What sets Sweden apart, I think, is partly what we talked about before, this impersonal trust. You trust your neighbors, trust your politicians and scientists, which means then that they can trust you a little bit. If they recommend social distancing, they think that you're going to do it if you can. And we think that they say so, not because they're crazy or want to ruin our lives. We think they say so because they think it's important. And then most people abide by that. So I think the trust issue is important. But then there's also another reason, which is simply that we have a different version of division of powers in Sweden than almost every other country, almost every other place, which is that government authorities, they have lots of independence in making decisions. They're not politicized in the same way they are in other places. The government appoints the head of the public health authority, for example, but they're not supposed to tell him what to do. He is supposed to follow the law and look at the facts and make his own decisions and come up with recommendations about what to do. And then obviously, if the government wants to do something else, they can do it. But this has created a tradition of listening to expert authorities in Sweden, whereas in most other places, those issues become politicized so quickly. And when they're politicized, you have to respond to an immediate voter demand. Whereas in Sweden, the public health authority said that, no, look, our plan on handling the pandemic, any pandemic, was looked like this, and we haven't seen any facts, no data that suggests that another path would help us in a better way. So let's stick to it. And that gave, could be that it just gave the government a fig leaf, sort of, okay, let's do it, because we can always blame them afterwards if they do it. But that's the way it happened. And I think, and you know, the public trust in the government and in the public health authority increased during the pandemic. So it seems like they made a good call.
Well, I think Americans have a lot they can learn from Sweden. It's just none of the lessons they think they're going to learn.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
Well, Johan, I'm so happy to have spent this time talking about so much stuff with you. What are you working on now as we wrap up? What are you actively grappling with? Do you have a new book? You've obviously just released your book. Tell us about where we can find that and where people can kind of find what you're doing now.
Yeah, well, now I'm working with on my book, Open: The Story of Human Progress, which will be published in the US November 15. And it's really about how openness creates progress, but we don't like it. Why don't we like it? It's difficult to live with openness because we want this sense of certainty, predictability that we get in the tribe or in the big government. And that has historically often led us to undermine that openness and so destroyed that progress. So I'm looking at our psychology and I'm looking at historical crises like depressions and pandemics and how they often undermine our belief, our faith in freedom and what to do about that.
Man, there couldn't be a better time to hear your thoughts on that. I'm really looking forward to reading that book. Well,
thanks.
Thanks for coming on board, and let's definitely be staying in touch.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Emergent Order podcast. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. If you're interested in being a guest, shoot us an email at podcast@emergentorder.com. Our producer is Jesse Bennett. Thanks again, and speak to you next time.